Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. We kick off this Wednesday with a 1925 Texas Penal Code that says that, well, at least it said back in 1925 when this penal code was put together, that it is illegal to milk another person's cow. So illegal, in fact, that one could face a fine of up to $10. Now, of course, this penal code has been repealed since. This law does not stand today, but interesting times indeed when it did. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, proudly brought to you by Volvo. And on the show today, we take a look at infrastructure in all its forms. We've got a conversation with the PIC, the Public Investment Corporation, around their view on the African continent's infrastructure development goals and what it is that can be done to achieve those goals. Then we've got a conversation with the team at Standard Bank around unlocking capital and reducing the cost of capital on the African continent for financing things like infrastructure projects. And then we've got a conversation with the team at the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation of South Africa, taking a look at the transformation of the energy sector in South Africa and the infrastructure around that. Then we're going to wrap up the show with an executive lounge conversation. We speak to the CEO of Future Forex, Harry Scherzer. We get to know him a little bit better and get to know what he does beyond running a business that he helped build back in the pandemic.
This program is powered by Volvo Plug-in Hybrids. You've upgraded everything else in your life, so isn't it time your car caught up too? It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
We kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have moved throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by founder at Just One Lap and good friend Simon Brown to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Si, always lovely catching up, always lovely having you on the show. A stronger day for the Rand, the Aussie back above 100,000 points, equity markets across the board having a green day. I don't think there was a single equity market that I found in the red. Markets seemingly shrugging off as much as they can. I can't help but wonder if markets have been listening to some Taylor Swift and shaking things off lately.
Evening, Jimmy. Yes, I mean, markets are strong, absolutely. So as you point out, we're back just below the all-time highs. Rand down 17.76 and a bit, and lots of green everywhere. Resources winning the day. We had AngloGold Ashanti up through 1,000 Rand. That's been a stormer of a stock. Gold running higher. But to your point, what we're doing is we are ignoring that tomorrow a lot of tariffs just come into effect. And, you know, President Trump's now saying he's going to double the tariffs on India in 21 days to 50%. The bigger picture is that we've all, you know, it's not just about how do, you know, the local stocks, you know, involved in the citrus exports and vehicles and the like. This is going to have global economic implications in terms of GDP growth, potentially interest rates, unemployment, etc. And the market is, we've been speaking about this for months now, the market is just shaking it off.
Si, you bring up that India tariff, and I just saw that as well, doubling or adding an additional 25% tariffs on India over its imports of Russian oil. This would take India's tariffs to 50%. When we look at that, you and I have spoken about this in private conversations and outside of sort of our radio conversations that we do. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about Trump being a bully. Now, where do we draw the line as global market participants between somebody imposing tariffs just because they are able to and the market responding? Because the reality is the tariffs have a material impact on the businesses that operate in that sector. And even if we don't agree with the tariffs, we can't necessarily say that they're not going to exist. But at the same time, a president probably shouldn't be allowed to just impose tariffs because they don't like a relationship.
Absolutely, and he does have power on it. Congress can pull back on it, but the president certainly can issue the tariffs. And to your point, in the immediate, there's not much many economies can do. And you know, Brazil, India, China, Some of the biggest trading partners, Europe, UK, Japan. I mean, these are the biggest trading partners, and there's not much they can do against Trump, and he will just, you know, retaliate in a sense. It is going to, if it continues, and there's, you know, 3.5 years more of Trump, if it continues the next 3.5 years, it is going to fundamentally change global trade, and it's going to be a rocky process.
So what does that mean for South Africa's case? I mean, at this point, if India is getting additional tariffs merely for importing Russian oil, we could expect additional tariffs for saying the wrong things.
We absolutely can. Part of the problem is, you know, the idea being we'll take our citrus fruit and redirect it to other markets. Other citrus fruit growers who were exporting into the US are also now competing in those markets. So it's going to be tough in that regard. And, you know, some of our commodities are exempt. And generally, commodities are being exempt from the process. That certainly helps. But it is going to, you know, it runs the risk of, we've seen the reports early in the week about, you know, potential massive job losses in East London. Because of the Mercedes plant there, 30% tariff. Philippines has a car that same car, 15% tariff. They're going to buy the Philippine one, so it's going to hurt.
Sai, looking at the rand is also still shaking things off. 1779, just below 1780. We were at 1840 at some stage. Now this could, as you said, change very, very quickly when midnight tomorrow night happens and those tariffs officially come into effect from a South African perspective. Do we expect markets to get more volatile? I mean, I had a look at the markets. We seemingly bounced quite nicely. And I think you and I spoke about this on Monday, saying the bounce off of the what was expected to have been implemented on Friday, that bounce was quite a sharp one, indicating that the market is pricing everything in as much as it can.
It absolutely is, you know, and we are trading at all time highs, and it is. I mean, it's on the back more than anything of our resources are still going very, very strong. The Resi 10 is having a blisteringly good year, and that is pushing us higher. But it is, and it's I don't want to be the sort of doomsday, but there's a disconnect between what markets are saying and what sort of global growth, interest rates, and the like are saying. The one caveat: if the US starts to cut aggressively, that will certainly help. Not sure that's going to happen under Jerome Powell, but he does leave in May of next year, and the next Fed chair maybe will be more tentative towards cuts. We had two votes to cut, so there was dissent in the last meeting. I think that's the first time since Bill Clinton was president.
Sai, you mentioned that Jerome Powell's term does come to an end, and I can't imagine that President Trump is keen to renew that, but that is still, at this point, probably around almost 300 more days away. And you and I have spoken about this, saying that there are more than 1,200 days of the Trump presidency left. That's a very, very long time. And a lot can happen in that time. But perhaps let's move to some local developments. Perhaps let's move to Glencore. Glencore gave us a 2025 half-year update on their business, or at least a report around their business. It seems as though they have been on the receiving end of some tough selling prices on the coal side of their business. Take us through just some of the performance highlights there that stood out for you. I mean, Glencore is a significant player in the energy space.
They absolutely are. And they're also undergoing significant restructuring in business. Coal, as you mentioned, coal is not a fun place to be. It coal prices are under pressure, and there's a glut of supply at this point in time. So coal is really not a great business. They've had if I look broadly at Glencore, and I think around a moment ago I said the Resi's had a really, really great year. Glencore opened the year around 85, currently trading around 68. It's been much lower. Back in April, it was down at 55. But the market has not been rewarding it as a commodity play. They did announce a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, when they did their trading update. They talked a lot about cost cutting and how they're going to focus on the sort of the new energy metals. And they've certainly got those. And they've got a bunch of it. The coal part, not a nice part. And they've got to get that billion rand out of the business, because at the moment, the market has not been liking them at all.
So let's wrap up our conversation with a look at Astoria Investments, another company that gave us an update on their performance. I know that the company typically doesn't get much attention because it is domiciled in Mauritius, but they gave us an update on the 6 months ended June 2025, as many companies have been updating us at this stage. The NAV of the company coming under a bit of pressure there. I'm seeing those numbers coming in a little softer. The earnings per share almost halving down quite a bit there from that perspective. We know that, of course, we can look at these sorts of performances from companies and see that the pressure is being felt in some industries, whereas in other industries or other companies, they might be doing well. What do you make of their performance? I mean, understanding they're an investment company by and large, and so it could potentially be that some of their subsidiaries aren't doing so well.
Yeah, they are an investment holding company. And as you say, I mean, Jimmy, they're having a tough time. I mean, net asset value, just under 60 cents. It was just over 77 previously. It is as I look at the market now, the last trades I can see were back in June. It's a deeply illiquid stock. And in fact, no, so there have been some others, but very small trades. And it's an odd one on the market. It's Petrolin, and this story, must remember, came out of Anchor, and they listed it as a $1 offshore investment. And then eventually, essentially sold it out. And it is now just a holding company. And they've got some great assets, but they're finding it tough out there. And I think that's a fair reflection. We talk around the South African consumer being better off than they were a year ago, but it's still very tough.
I suppose holding companies do have the challenge of not only trading at discounts, but having markets be perhaps unfair towards the valuations of their underlying assets. And that is not just isolated to companies like Astoria. We've seen it happen with the likes of Remgro and other companies trading at deep discounts to what they would consider their net asset value. But that's a conversation for another day. Thank you to Si for the insights and for the time. Always lovely having you on the show. Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap and good friend of our show, joining us to take a look at market movements and what seems to be the order of the day.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In business, you need more than banking. You need a partner that moves at your speed and understands your industry. At Absa Business Banking, we get it.
The Industrial Development Corporation, that is the IDC in South Africa, the PIC rather, we are looking at the Public Investment Corporation. They went through a research exercise and compiled quite an interesting survey sharing the PIC's perspectives around accelerating infrastructure development in Africa and how we get that done. I'm joined on the line by Senior Specialist for Africa at the Public Investment Corporation, that's Brenton Lalu, to take a look at their insights and what it is that they've uncovered. Brenton, lovely to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with an overview of the importance of African infrastructure development. I can imagine with the position that the PIC plays as, if I'm not mistaken, the largest asset manager in the public sphere, at least on the African continent, by assets under management. It's a significant thing to be looking at from a PIC perspective to say, what does Africa's infrastructure conversation look like and where does it go?
Good evening, Jimmy. Thank you for having me, and good evening to your listeners. Firstly, infrastructure isn't just about roads or power lines. I think it's probably about unlocking Africa's full potential. I think if we look at infrastructure today, the gap on the continent is costing it. And it's a drag on livelihoods, job creation, long-term competitiveness. We see as well fragmented transport networks, there's underpowered energy systems, and ugly uneven access to water and sanitation, even digital services. These gaps just hold back regional trade, limit private investment, and hit ugly rural and low-income communities the hardest. Africa's growing cities, they have a booming population, we have so many things going for us, but they are also climate risks. They make the need for resilient, connected infrastructure more urgent than it's ever been before. And I think without action, the financing gap stands at over $100 billion a year, will grow even wider in the future. I think infrastructure is not just a foundation of economic growth, it unlocks missing links, unlocks bottlenecks on the continent. It's a bridge that allows us to enable regional integration and inclusive development.
Brenton, I'm going to send you back to our production team. I'm going to put a pin in the bottleneck conversation of infrastructure development because we have to have you on a better line. This is a conversation we can ill afford to miss. So we're just going to shoot you back to our production team for 2 seconds to see if we can get you on a better line. While we do that, let me perhaps give you a sense of some of the other developments that have been taking place within the South African landscape, at least from today's perspective. As we spoke to Simon a little earlier on around that Glencore performance, there have been some updates as well in terms of SENS announcements from other companies, the likes of Wesizwe, giving us an update on some resignations within their boards, corporate adjustments seemingly taking place from a company perspective. And the team at the Jubilee Metals Group gave us an update on their Zambian copper business. Copper seems to be all the rage at the moment, and Jubilee's strategy around that Zambian copper business seems to be something that they are looking forward to continuing to unpack from an integrated mining perspective. And I think we do have Brenton back on the line. Brenton, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm back. Apologies for that.
Oh, there we go. That's so much better. So before we got separated, we were discussing the bottlenecks on the African continent around infrastructure development. Take us perhaps through some of the bottlenecks, some of the barriers, and just some of the hindrances that we're seeing play out that might be preventing infrastructure development from being where it should be.
Sure. So what's really holding Africa's infrastructure back? And it's not just about money. I think it's more about momentum. If you look at the report, we focus on nearly 80% of projects stall before they ever break ground. And the reason is because systems are backlogged with bottlenecks. There's regulation delays, meaning projects can take years to get approvals. There's feasibility studies that drag on or aren't bankable. If you look at land rights, they're often disputed. If you look at procurement, they're slow and quite inconsistent. And many institutions simply don't have the technical capacity to plan, appraise, and manage large-scale projects at speed. I think there's also a lack of coordination between the players. If you look at ministries, between countries, and even financiers, that makes the regional projects like transport corridors or power pools much harder to deliver in Africa.
Brenton, so then how does a PIC, for example, navigate this? Because the PIC has a very important role as a DFI, that's a Development Finance Institute, within the ecosystem alongside other DFIs, to be able to fast track the financing, to be able to invest, to be able to take on the risk that others might not be able to. And some of the projects, honestly, only really the PIC can afford to finance. But if the PIC is seeing these bottlenecks as well, I can only imagine as an investment house, as an asset manager, if I was in your position, I'd say, okay, then we're not going to deploy the capital. That creates almost a barrier, if I think about it, to say, well, if there's so many blockages and bottlenecks that are being caused here, then our capital is going to get tied up, whereas it can be deployed somewhere else. So how then do you approach the conversation as a DFI and as an asset manager?
Sure. So I agree. Asset managers have a critical role to play in solving this puzzle. It is a puzzle. Why? I think because as asset managers, as a PIC, we're not just investors. We see ourselves as long-term partners. We manage capital that needs to be put to work responsible at scale and for impact as well. So we help structure deals, assess risk, and ensure governance is strong from planning to delivery. But in a landscape where public budgets are stretched and bankable projects are quite few, asset managers can bridge that gap. They can work with DFIs, they can work with other pension funds. I think they can also work with the project sponsors to unlock capital and arguably, most importantly, confidence, investor confidence. We need to be stewards for institutional savings, bringing discipline, accountability, and clear-eyed focus on risk-adjusted returns with impact. That's without losing sight of the development goals of the continent. So I think, in short, asset managers can help turn infrastructure from just an ambitious project into execution. And I think that's what's really needed in Africa right now, is execution.
Brendan, something else that's needed in Africa is building almost fit-for-purpose solutions. We know very clearly that the challenges that Africa faces as a continent, as a developing continent, are not the same as some of the other continents that we have in the world. And therefore, when we build solutions that are supposed to benefit Africa, we should be building them to what we require and the spec that we require. How do we navigate that conversation, and how do we ensure that we're not just throwing out a solution and saying, well, there's the solution, and the solution makes no sense for what or for the context that we need it to?
Sure. So I think cut and paste solutions for Africa won't work. We can't keep applying global infrastructure magics that were built for, we need something that was built for our realities. We have to break away from the norm and the design solutions that actually fits our context in Africa. That either means having flexible financing for informal economies. It means project preparation that accounts for fragmented land ownership, or embracing local materials, local skills, and local knowledge. Africa building African infrastructure. So we need tools that work in low data environments, contracts that are reflect cross-border complexities that we have, and I think timelines that respect our local capacity issues, but don't compromise the ambition we have. I think Africa's infrastructure's future can't be imported with other models. It has to be designed for purpose from the ground up. Because I think if we want transformational results in Africa, we need to change our thinking, and we need transformational thinking and executional thinking within African infrastructure.
Brenton, that transformational thinking, before I let you go, as a parting thought, should we not be leveraging off of technology? I mean, the African continent is young. The African people have probably the youngest average age of any continent in the world, if I'm not wrong. And surely that means we are easily adaptable towards the changes. And technology has been one of those changes. Should we be leveraging that to accelerate our development and say, where we lack, we're going to leverage technology so that we can catch up quicker?
100%. So I think in the report, we've highlighted four pillars, and the pillars are policy and regulatory reform, innovative finance, pillar three, what we spoke about now, technology, and pillar four, capacity. All of those pillars need to work together. But coming back to technology, I think it's important for us to leverage these. So we've got aspects like digital tools, such as building information modeling used in engineering. There's geospatial analytics, Internet of Things, that can enhance transparency, reduce the inefficiencies, and improve project delivery. I think by scaling these tools, we require common data standard, regulatory support, and targeted digital training throughout. So it is possible to leverage tech and digital integration, but I think it's also important to have all these pillars that I've mentioned offer a coherent strategy to move the projects from just planning to execution, and from execution to actually impact the community that you're serving.
Execution is vital if we are to get the infrastructure development right on the African continent, but strategic execution is the order of the day. We'll leave this conversation on that note, Brenton. Thank you so much for those insights and for sharing the report with us. Brenton Lalu, Senior Sector Specialist for Africa at the Public Investment Corporation, sharing their perspectives around accelerating infrastructure development in the African continent.
In business, you need more than banking. You need deep sector expertise and personalized partnerships that take you further. At Absa Business Banking, we get it. In business, the pace doesn't slow when pressure hits. Whether you're plating up at peak hour, tables packed, orders piling, we've got to move faster, or racing to meet a deadline.
Truck held at the border.
Client needs answers. You need more than banking. You need flexible funding, real-world tools, and sector expertise that shows up when it counts. At Absa Business Banking, we get it. Because your story matters. Absa is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, proudly brought to you by Volvo. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So the need for infrastructure development on the African continent is abundantly clear, but what is also clear is that this is not a cheap exercise. And interestingly enough, to that effect, entirely coincidentally, today Standard Bank, alongside a couple of other partners, held its cost of capital summit for infrastructure investment on the African continent. The aim of this was to highlight the importance of adequate financing and capital deployment within development markets or within developing markets. And Standard Bank, as the lead sponsor of the B20, has put forward a series of conversations around why understanding the cost of capital is so important. I'm joined on the line by the executive head of international trade at Standard Bank's business and commercial banking division, that is Luthando Vuba, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Luthando, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with a look at why the cost conversation is so important when we are looking at capital.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks for having me, and greetings to the listeners. At Standard Bank, as the largest bank in Africa by assets and also our footprint covering multiple territories, this is a direct sort of challenge that we face in the markets that we operate in. And when you look at what's required for development anyway in the world, by any country, infrastructure is certainly a key lever of that. I mean, I just have to take us back to pre-2010 for us to understand that pre-2010 we didn't have BRT and the Gautrain, a speed train, and now we do. So it's certainly, and we can talk, you know, at length as to just what that has triggered and sort of attracted in terms of further investment into those nodes and but also into the country. And so infrastructure is a very critical role to the development of any country. And the way we look at it, Standard Bank, as part of this G20 process, which is a very monumental, pivotal moment, not just for South Africa, but for the continent. As part of the B20 process, how do we elevate the key themes and the things that really move the dial forward around what we need to see around infrastructure development? Certainly that needs capital, that needs an investment into it. And when you look at the barriers to that, this is certainly one of the components that is directly impeding on that, because the cost of capital and the cost at which African sovereigns are obtaining capital to date is very high. Just to give you a data point, OECD countries on average pay around 6% of their budget towards debt servicing. That for African countries ranges between 17% to 50%. That's 50% of the budget that a country would have to spend towards development, towards the social services, and the range of things that government provides. So it is quite a critical part of why we are seeing the lag in African development.
Luthando, since this is a critical point in development, as you mentioned, for any country, I can imagine it becomes that much more important for a developing continent like Africa. And I want to get your thoughts from a Standard Bank perspective. I mean, you alluded to it a little earlier, and this is something I've mentioned on the show. It's a known fact. Standard Bank is the largest bank by assets on the African continent, which also means then that as a bank, you have the added advantage of being able to use your footprint to see what the development needs look like on the African continent. How crucial does infrastructure then play to these conversations of development, of growth, of sustainability?
No, certainly. Jimmy, there was an interesting statistic mentioned by Ndidi from one organization this morning, where she annotated that 3 out of 5 African children are born in countries with debt distress. I start with that because it gives the picture, both from future looking, but also where we find ourselves. You know, often Africa is, we quote, you know, the demographic dividend, and by 2040, 1 in 4 youth population will be in Africa. But this is the current setting. And for us as Standard Bank, it's a real sort of challenge that we face, that we try and in our own way and through our institutional relationships to really help get projects off the ground, and, you know, help finance and the trade part of it, which is both on the export and the import side. And I particularly want to touch on that because it relates to infrastructure, but it also relates to how cost of capital impedes on that. We have the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, which presents an opportunity for better trade and more trade intra-Africa. And quite a bit of our countries have a very constant, have a very significant contribution that comes from the agricultural sector. However, in South Africa, we are ranging around 10 to 20% of our agriculture sector that is subsistence farmers, and the majority is commercial farmers. When you go outside of South Africa, that picture is flipped. So it means that we are growing, but it is not, you know, with the infrastructure that's there to really produce at scale. So it means that industrialization then becomes a key thing to boost that. And there's a demand for what is grown on the continent for exports. So when it comes to importing and the machinery, et cetera, becomes very critical in how you get the processing and increase that. And at times, I look after trade within the group. At times, we are unable to support some of the clients with their transaction because either there's an FX liquidity challenge, or sometimes it's just the risk appetite or the lending rates are just too high to be able to make sure that a deal is still a responsible lending deal. So that is practically what we encounter in some of the markets, and that you can tie back to, at times, the risk grade of that country and how it's rated from a risk perception. And at times, it's also the reason why there's FX reserve strain is because when African countries are servicing their debt, they're servicing it in the foreign currency. And that's just a practical way of just what we encounter and how we see this cost of capital conversation impact our operations, our clients that we service in the different markets.
Lutando, country risk premiums have come up in a lot of the discussions, and Africa seems to have a higher country risk premium than other continents. And I want to take a look at that and see how we reduce that, the role of banks like Standard Bank on the African continent. I mean, we've just spoken to the PIC, which sits as an asset manager in their own right on the African continent, about their role. I want to get your thoughts from an ecosystem perspective, the role that you and other banks like Standard Bank play on the African continent in reducing the risk premium of our continent.
Yeah, I think the role that the commercial banks play is one that's a critical one, and at times you could argue probably the most active one that's really fostering some of the development of the trade on the continent. And I think there could be a better, you know, a review of, you know, how we, you know, assess appetite, but also closer working with our public institutions and how we look at this particular one. And I particularly want to raise this one around both blended finance and one of the themes coming up around PPPs, which is, you know, institutionalizing South Africa from a policy perspective, but that's not a case in other African markets. And I think this would be a good and a key learning that, you know, if we can have the other African sovereigns look at that, because it certainly helps with mobilizing and leveraging the skills that is coming from private sector together with public sector to deliver on some of those projects that are for the good of the country or the development of the country. So blended finance, I think, is another alternative, because when it comes to looking at infrastructure projects outside of the DFIs and the commercial banks such as ourselves, there's an opportunity for us to look at what other capital sits there. And increasingly over time, philanthropic capital has been quite interested in, you know, where else they could, you know, get into or participate in terms of the funds that they sit with. So I think one of the recommendations, this theme around looking at blended finance and looking at philanthropic capital in that space, but also how philanthropic capital could play a role even in the public-private partnership space. So these are some of the alternative ways that we could look at plugging this gap. The required capital for African infrastructure spend annually is sitting at around $170 billion US dollars. We currently are able to mobilize $85 billion US dollars. So half of that is sitting as a gap. And these are some of the ways that we think, together with other commercial banks, but most importantly, other financial institutions, especially also development finance institutions and multilateral development banks, with their expertise and credit assessment and tools and expertise when it comes to even the projects and preparing them, making sure that they're investable. I think there's a lot more we can leverage from these global partners.
Unlocking more affordable finance and capital for Africa's development requires a coordinated coordinated effort, and that coordinated effort means that we all have to do our parts, depending on which part of the ecosystem you sit in. We'll leave this conversation on that note, Luthando. Thank you so much for the insights. That was Luthando Vuba, the Executive Head of International Trade at Standard Bank's Business and Commercial Banking, joining us to take a look at the cost of capital on the African continent and how we reduce that.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You are listening to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, proudly brought to you by Volvo. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Industrial Development Corporation, committed to enabling production of clean energy. Visit idc.co.za for more.
The conversations around transformation continue to be important conversations to be had. And alongside those conversations, we have conversations particularly around energy transformation, or at least transformation within the energy sector. Now, one organization in South Africa that is passionate about this and that has put their money where their mouth is the Industrial Development Corporation of South Africa. I'm joined on the line by the Business Development Manager at the IDC's Energy Strategic Business Unit, Nondu Ngidi, to take a look at their commitments towards the transformation of the energy sector and what that looks like. Nondu, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with an overview of the energy sector at the moment. I mean, we've gone through a year almost of a very somewhat stable energy supply regime. We know that we've had our challenges in the past in South Africa around that. But from your perspective as the IDC, and certainly as an investor in this space, how are you seeing the energy space with the conversations around new entrants, with conversations around new licensing? How are you seeing the energy space at the moment?
Thank you for having me on the show. And really, we look forward to these engagements as the IDC. Our view on the energy sector is quite optimistic and positive in that we do see growth and we see opportunities for investment, not only by DFIs, but the entire financial market. So we are encouraged and we see positive developments as it relates to Eskom's energy availability factor. As an institution focused on driving industrialization, energy security is a key enabler to achieving this goal and seeing South Africa's economy grow. At the peak of load shedding, we noted how this adversely impacted our portfolio, which really comprises of commercial and industrial clients. Although we see that energy supply has stabilized in the short term, we recognize that substantial investment remains necessary for infrastructure and renewable energy to facilitate the shift to a low carbon economy. And this is really in line with nationally determined targets, but also the integrated resource plan, which really provide a great framework for aligning future energy demands of South Africa. With that, we are of the view that while there are challenges that will remain in the sector, such as your evolving policy within the space, there are even greater opportunities for investment. And this is really to facilitate the energy sector's growth. But really, this calls for increased collaboration with the private sector in electricity generation and even stronger partnerships to accelerate the implementation of infrastructure projects. Our positive outlook as the IDC is really supported by the recent announcements around transmission procurement program and the subsequent rebid window rounds that will come to the market. And that really gives us a good indication that we should continue to support the sector.
Speaking of investments, Nundu, I want to take a look at what the IDC is looking at the moment. I mean, as it stands, the IDC has well over 10 billion rand invested in the energy space just in the South African market. With all of these new incoming entrants and all of the new projects that are emerging, there has always been a call for funding for these projects, everything from the transmission projects to the alternative energy projects. How does the IDC then see strategic investment going forward in this energy space?
Sure. I mean, the IDC specifically is heavily invested in the energy sector. Our portfolio comprises of investments that we've made under the government energy procurement program, and this would be under bid window 1 up to 6. We continue to support the government program. However, in the past 2 to 3 years, we've noticed that there's been an increase in investments in commercial and industrial market, or what others refer to as private offtake. This is where independent power producers are implementing renewable projects with industrial clients being offtakers. We have seen a few mining houses adopting or taking this route as part of their decarbonization strategy. And this is really to support the energy transition. This is quite important because decarbonization for some organization has not only been seen as a compliance exercise, but it's really implemented to address an operational risk in that certain trading partners will require mining houses to formulate decarbonization strategies and plans to demonstrate a clear path to energy transition. So as the IDC, we see ourselves playing a big role in terms of facilitating the energy transition, facilitating the entrance of new players in this sector. And this is really trying to take on a bigger risk because we understand some of these parties will not have the balance sheet, but they do have some experience. So as the IDC, that is really our core mandate, to support these players that seek to make a difference and change the landscape of the energy sector.
Nondu, part of all of these changes, these investments mean that companies can approach the IDC for financing of their projects, and that is a critical component of ensuring the success of these projects. Take me through how that financing looks different from what we would call mainstream financing at the moment. What does the IDC then offer that is a differentiated value proposition, and does that come with extra criteria that need to be met by companies that might be wanting to access IDC funding?
So the IDC, their approach in terms of supporting the energy sector, it's quite different from other financial institutions in that we seek to partner with commercial banks, other DFIs and other financial institutions to ensure that we fully support the energy sector. So as a DFI, our role is to ensure that the projects are bankable and they reach financial close. So part of that is identifying market failures, identifying gaps in these projects, and ensuring that we provide funding to ensure these projects are attractive to commercial banks and all the other financial institutions. So our value proposition is that we have a higher risk tolerance than most financial institutions, and therefore we are able to support the energy sector sufficiently.
And that energy sector does need all the support it can get if we're looking to transform it and make it fit for purpose in South Africa and potentially even on the African continent. We'll leave this conversation on that note. Nondu, thanks so much for those insights and for the time. Nondu Ngidi, Business Development Manager at the IDC's Energy Strategic Business Unit, joining us to take a look at supporting transformation within the energy space.
Talk to the IDC today about creating partnerships that enable the production of clean energy. Visit idc.co.za for more. The IDC is committed to enabling the production of clean energy. We are steadfast in the quest to advance transformation and inclusivity within the sector. From electricity to efficiency, we are striving to achieve energy supply security. From production to reduction, we are funding solutions that seek to support decarbonization pathways. If you want to create sustainable partnerships in the energy sector, visit idc.co.za for more.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power, you just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday. We have the privilege of speaking to some leading executives and getting to know them beyond their day-to-day and what makes them tick. This week's executive is the CEO of a company called Future Forex in South Africa. They are a licensed FSP that operates in the treasury space, amongst other things within South Africa. And the company CEO, Harry Scherzer, has graciously agreed to come onto the show to give us a bit more color around his life beyond what he does for work. Harry, lovely having you on the show. Why would you become an actuary? Why does one go into actuarial sciences? What happened there?
Jimmy, thanks for having me on. Great to chat to you this evening. It's a question of when you're 18 and you don't know what you want to do and you finish school and you've done relatively well at school, where do you go? And I guess for me, it just seemed, well, let's go for the thing that's the hardest. I'm good at maths. I like a challenge. Let me try actuarial science. The truth is, at 18, I had no idea what I wanted to do. But naturally, I just thought, well, I always want to challenge myself. Let's try this thing, and I can always drop to something easier if it doesn't work out. And fortunately, I did manage to make it through and become an actuary.
So what do you do after you do the hardest thing that you can find, Harry?
After you do the hardest thing you can find, you immediately step out of that role, realizing you didn't actually enjoy your actuarial work, and you move to what was, in my case, a glorified sales role. It was called a business development director. Truth is, more than anything, the skill it enhanced in me was a sales skill. And I mean, Jimmy, the quality of my life just so heavily increased when I moved away from a very technical role to one where I was dealing with people and working with people and making a real impact. So it was very clear to me that even though I had the ability to analyze models, to do actuarial audits, to do all these very complex technical things, what really gave me fulfillment is dealing with people and helping people. And so that was kind of when I shifted from the actuarial journey after my 3 years at EY to a more people-facing role as a business development director, and what led me to ultimately starting a company.
Quick side note before we get into those company details, anyone considering venturing down the road of actuarial sciences would be pleased to know that Harry is one of less than 1,800 qualified actuaries in South Africa, at least according to the Actuarial Society of South Africa. Harry, let's get into the business side of things. What then becomes an attractive business for an actuary?
Yeah, so Jimmy, For me, it was a matter of I always knew I wanted to start something. And what I knew more than that is I wanted to make a massive impact in the world and in South Africa in particular. Impact is what drives me more than anything else. And so when having completed my actuarial exams, the first thing I actually tried to start, my business partner and I, was an ed tech company. Not many people know this, but effectively, we tried to partner with UNISA in... And it was just pre-COVID. It would have done very well if it had worked out. But we tried to partner with UNISA in basically allowing online lectures for UNISA students. UNISA has hundreds of thousands of students, and it's all sort of done via textbooks and very few lectures, if any. And we thought if we can make an excellent platform to make this online, that's something that would be very exciting to UNISA and to the future of South Africa, really. That was business number one we tried to start, but unfortunately, UNISA didn't really want to partner with us in the end, despite us having what I believe an incredible product for them. I won't go into the politics there, but in a nutshell, we kind of had to pivot and we had to say, do we want to continue this edtech thing? And as it happened, both myself and my business partner were making a bit of extra money on the side doing crypto arbitrage, which is the process of buying cryptocurrency in America and selling it in South Africa at a profit, because there's a bit of a price gap there. It's a bit more expensive in South Africa. And when needing to pivot to figuring out if we're going to do this, if we're going to privatize this edtech company, or if we're instead going to actually allow crypto arbitrage to be something we're going to do for other people and make incredible returns doing that, it became pretty abundantly clear to us that actually the crypto arbitrage side was something we were more passionate about. It had better market fit. And to be honest, it was something that could make a bigger impact, because privatizing education, you have the same issue again, where the people that really need help with education are those that don't have the money to afford a privatized system. So we kind of lost the excitement in that business and pivoted very heavily to help others to effectively democratize this incredible opportunity of crypto arbitrage. And so back in 2020, we officially started Future Forex.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Harry, when you're not focused on work and you're not focused on building the businesses that you've built over the years, how do you wind down?
Well, I've got a lot of ways of winding down, and the things that I use to wind down would wind a lot of people up. For example, I play a lot of chess, and I do this before bed quite often on my phone. I play online chess, which people think I'm crazy to do because it requires immense concentration. So if ever I have sort of a break in the day or late at night, I tend to play online chess because I absolutely love it, and it actually relaxes me despite it stimulating my brain. So that's one of my hobbies that I really enjoy and have done my whole life. I actually used to play for Western Province for, I think it was 12 years running. So I've really enjoyed chess my whole life. But more recently, I've taken to the paddle court. I've got the paddle bug, and also some five-a-side football. So yeah, I guess running, five-a-side football, paddle, and a lot of chess is what calms me down.
Harry, how do you keep up with all of this?
You know, it's really, I'm a very busy person with a lot of energy. I don't sleep for more than, call it, maximum 7 hours a night. I work really hard, and I guess I play hard. I just like being active. I'm an extrovert by nature, so I love dealing with people. I love getting things done, and I think that energy has fed into the way I've run the company, because you need a lot of energy to start a new age fintech, which hires now 160 people. You know, if you don't have that energy and you don't have that all-in attitude, I think it's really tough to be successful.
Harry, how does success look now for you? As someone who's achieved quite a bit in your life thus far, what then continues to drive you beyond the impact and the difference that you're able to make in people's lives? How do you then approach challenges these days?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jimmy. And I think what it comes down to is the fact that you want to make as much impact as possible. I was in Dubai earlier this year at a top 40 under 40 global event, which I was lucky enough to receive in the banking and finance sector. And the theme of the event, because this was a bunch of people that have achieved a lot at a very early age, and the theme of the event was like, exactly your question. What continues to drive you? You've already achieved things. What are you doing this for? What's the point? And I think everyone echoed the same sentiment, which was around impact. Impact was the big fundamental thing that came out of that event.
Making an impact is so important, and Harry enjoys doing the most. Harry, thank you so much for those insights and for giving us a bit more insight around who it is that you are beyond the day-to-day responsibilities at Future Forex. Harry Schertz, the CEO of Future Forex, joining us for our executive lounge.
This show was powered by Volvo Plug-in Hybrids.
You don't need diesel power. You just need a second electric motor. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
And it's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coast is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.